started. It is Tuesday, July 21st, 2020, at 7:03 PM, and we are meeting in the Sierra Hills Community Center. We will start this meeting with a pledge, which I will lead, and the invocation will be given by Councilmember Stanton. Everyone will please rise.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this opportunity we have to meet this evening as a city and to look at the needs of our city and the needs of our citizens and to be creative in our solutions and sympathetic and to the needs that we see and to ways that we can improve our community and make it a great place to live. And please bless those who will speak to us tonight and bless us with understanding and with the ability to get our points across and to make good, sound decisions. We're grateful for this opportunity and we say this to the community.
Amen. Thank you. Moving on to item number two is approval of the meeting's agenda. If somebody would like to make that motion.
I move that we approve the meeting's agenda.
The motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second.
And seconded by Councilmember Anderson. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. So we'll move on to item number three, which is the public comment portion. And I show one person on our list, which is Jason Hart. If you'll come up to the microphone, so we'll bring in the address, and you'll have 3 minutes.
Sure. How about you and disposable? This is not disposable, so I leave it here.
My name is Jason Har, address is 10483 North East Street Way. Everybody knows me. So just to reiterate, we met and I appreciate the council and the city approving and completing the trajectory studies for the driving range. So first, I just want to say that I've read the results, and it's obvious that the current design of the driving range and the height of the nets is insufficient. That's been a concern this entire time for the last 4 years, and I think the study can prove that. So given this, I just also suggest, in conjunction with the staff recommendations, to not only go to irons only, but to ensure that the T's are also angled north. I just didn't see that under the staff recommendation. I just think that's important as well until a long-term solution is, come to for the driving range. And especially because of the documentation from the study actually showing that the driving range angles a little bit south anyways. So I think that's critical as well, that the T-boxes are always angled north. So that's my main point. Just appreciate everyone for doing the study, and I just hope to take it seriously, and we can get this problem solved once and for all over some time. And as a side note, my house was hit yesterday many times, but on one of those, a citizen actually came to my house, and first time in 5 years, and actually just wanted to make me aware of that. So I asked him, and I said, hey, was it a driver or an iron? And he said, yeah, it was a driver. So just a side note there. And then just yesterday as well, just because I knew we were coming, just after work, I picked up 56 balls yesterday in 15 minutes, and 41 today in 15 minutes, just from the park and south of Cotton. So I don't know if there's an high school team there or corporate events, but it just seems like the last 2 weeks have been kind of done. Not sure why. That's all I have. Just I hope we can go to irons only until a solution is found. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Harper is the only one on the list. Is there anyone else here that wanted to speak during the public comment portion of the meeting? Seeing none, I will close that portion of the meeting and move to item number four, which is the consent agenda, and that is an approval of the minutes for the June 16th, 2020 work session of the City Council meeting. If somebody would like to make that motion.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
Is Chan by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Smith. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Moving on to items 5 and 6, which is city reports and business, starting with Mr. Goodwin.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. A few quick recreation notes is we have started a few recreation programs in light of the COVID pandemic. We've had T-ball and coaches pitch. They're wrapping up tomorrow. It's been a great season. We've limited the participants, but otherwise it's been a good season. Golf is having another phenomenal month, so we're excited about what's happening here at the golf course. I know that's going to be a big focus of the meeting tonight, so we'll talk more. Last weekend, we did have our first Family Festival Cedar Hills Pickleball Tournament on our own courts, and that was a huge success. We want to commend Laurie and her recreation staff, and the recreation staff for the work that they did on that. And then in August, we do have a number of events that are starting to come back onto the calendar, which is a good thing, and you can see around us that there are measures to ensure that social distancing is taking place at these types of events. So we want to commend the event staff as well. And then finally, as we approach the 24th of July, I know fireworks are really awesome, but Harvey Park is not an awesome place to light them. So we would ask that just as you drive by or you see fireworks going off in the park, that we call the police. Those are illegal. So, and just be mindful of the areas throughout the city where we do have high risk that we are not doing fireworks illegally in those areas. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Councilor?
Nothing to
report. Councilor Smith?
Nothing to
report. As far as my reports, ULCT did have a weekly web chat last week. They gave some information on the CARES Act funding. And one of the things that was just clarified for us, which is a huge impact, not just for our city, but for all cities, is that the Treasury has recently released an updated frequently asked questions, which indicates that public safety expenses can be presumed to be related to COVID mitigation and can be used for that purpose. So that would be helpful from a budget perspective with public safety this year. And then Economic Recovery Committee has continued to meet every week, and we have released a plan for small business grants, which is, there are $15 million available throughout the county for that. And I believe they send that to each of the cities. I think we're sending that out on Monday, is that right? So that we'll be sending that information out to all of our residents as well, especially small business owners who may be able to apply for that. And then there will be more information coming out within the next week about how nonprofits can also apply for over $5 million in economic recovery as well. Councilmember Anderson,
I have nothing to report.
Councilmember Ellsworth?
Nothing to report.
Councilmember Bettis?
Nothing.
All right, and then we'll move on to our scheduled items on public hearings, starting with number 7, a review action on an ordinance that involves all the local costs to City Code Title 1.
Mayor, Council, I'll be forgive me if I repeat myself from work session. For those in the audience tonight, I'd like to give some background. The first two items that we're talking about tonight really lead into each other a little bit, so if there's some overlap, I apologize, but I think it's kind of related issues. But as we look at our golf course, and as we said in my manager report, that golf is having a fantastic year. We saw the budget numbers, and we'll see that in our audit financial statements when they come out later this year, and we're off to a great start this year. But with that, we've seen a number of issues related to incidents in the course where a golf ball didn't quite go where the golfer intended it to. And I think that that's probably a result of the fact that we're seeing a larger number of golfers on our course than we've ever had before, so the probability of incidents is probably greater than it's ever been. With that, we do have a few areas on the course where we repeatedly see these incidents occur. Areas where you have the juxtaposition of municipal golf course adjacent to residential highway or residential home. And the kind of the one I'd like to highlight tonight is actually hole 16. We spoke about this in the work session. But on hole 16, here you have Canyon Road that is running north-south adjacent to this hole, but you also have these driving these homes that kind of appear that they're there's homes that appear that they're right in the path of a golf ball. So you see the tee boxes right here, and they look like they just came right for these homes. But as Mr. Hart indicated in his comments, that it really matters where you put the tee markers, and that they really kind of set the stage for how the golfer is going to approach that shot. If you're on hole 16, you see that we have these tee boxes, and we try to put the tee markers in a way in such a way that they aim for the center of the fairway here. But as it's hard to see with this projector, it's not working so well tonight. It's a little bright, but it wasn't working. But there's a tree right here. You can kind of see a shadow there. But as I imagine the golfer approaching his tee box, they see that tree down there in the distance where they're trying to aim, and so they aim just beside it. Well, they overcorrect their shot and they hook it right into these homes. And we had a window broken this year. Last year, and we had a window broken on this hole in the corner, and we had solar panel broken. Well, in the past, the city's policy has been golfers responsible for the trajectory responsible for the hit of their ball. And that is something that the city can still do. However, it doesn't really do much to rectify the problem in the long run. So staff and the legal team, we work to kind of create a policy or create a plan that would help the residents. And even though it says the no-fault golf policy, which kind of term refers to it as the good neighbor policy. What it does is it sets a line item in the budget that is explicitly for golf ball claims, whether they be windshields, windows, solar panels, fences, anything that's affected by golf ball. But what this does is it sets aside money in the golf fund that is used explicitly for these types of events. In order to fund this, staff is proposing that next year the city council consider an increase in green fees by 50 cents on 9 holes and a dollar on 18 holes that will go towards this fund. I recognize that money that's collected on those green fees is going to far exceed the amount that we're putting in this line item, but I think that plays into the long-term plan in that I think that the staff, golf staff, the planning staff, and city council need to plan and adopt a long-term strategy for mitigation of golf balls on the golf course. So whether that be, when we're talking about hole 16 here, we talk about simple measures here, where planting a few trees adjacent to the hole, the tee box here, could drastically affect the way that people approach this hole. And also cutting down or shearing this tree here so that it's not such an obstacle, in a way that allows people to more comfortably drive down the center of the fairway. However, that protects these homes. It doesn't do anything to protect vehicles that have been struck by golf balls on Canyon Road. So that's still a possibility. So there's always the possibility that something could occur, that there could be an incident. And I know that we talked about this very briefly in our last meeting, but I've had a change of heart at this simple work session that I do think this first year that we should improve visual line for windshields to be a part of this policy. And we'll see how it goes. We'll see what happens from this policy, and we'll see the end result is. And we'll revisit this next year. If there's an issue, if there's no issue, we'll probably just keep running with the same policy. So as we go into the policy itself, the code, there's three changes that I want you to make as part of the motion to the code tonight. One is under Title 114.1, Title Purpose. The way that it's written isn't broad enough, so we want to make sure that it's written correctly. But as it's written right now, it says it is the purpose of this chapter to compensate persons for vehicle damage, loss sustained. We want that to say vehicle damage, loss, and damage to private property, so it's clear that it's both instances, not just vehicle damage. And then the other two changes are not substantive, they're really just clerical. Numerical changes, how the code is numbered, and 10.114 changing notwithstanding to below birth. So they're pretty minor changes. So But when we're talking about the criteria for reimbursement, which is really what the, I think the meat of this code is, there are a few instances that will result in the denial of the application. That application, which is reviewed by the city attorney, not by city staff. One is that the loss is fully covered by private insurance, the party responsible for hitting the golf ball. Title there as well. And then the applicant is otherwise ineligible under the terms of this chapter. Loss caused by an irresponsible act of the applicant, applicant's agent, or member of the applicant's business or household. Loss or eligibility unsubstantiated. Loss caused by intentional acts of vandalism or malicious intent. Finally, loss caused by an individual who is not a paying patron of golf course. So we're trying to look at the instances that we've experienced in the past and try to formulate this program that protects the city from incidents that we don't feel are beyond, far beyond the city's responsibility, not just the developer's responsibility, but if somebody comes out and, you know, sneaks onto the course and starts to hit golf balls with a baseball bat on the driving range, this shouldn't cover that. That's a different act. That's what I call the police. But where we can substantiate the loss that it was a golfer that, you know, hit a ball, broke a window, and walked away, and that's really what we're talking about tonight. And then the maximum payments. It does limit the amount in the fund, and it does limit the incident to $300 per vehicle or $1,000 per incident, which can cover property damage to windows and solar panels, things of that nature. Council, you have a lot of questions in the work session. What other questions can I answer as part of this proposal?
There's one question. So we're talking about a mitigation plan, which is important, and it's a fantastic idea. I know we get questions about mitigation plans from people in the city. Would you be able to supply a schedule for a list of projects?
That's a very good question. And I'm not willing to propose anything tonight because that is something the staff is working on. In fact, on Thursday morning, we had an on-site meeting down there in the driving range to meet with a bunch of contractors to talk about redesigning the shape of that T-box down there. So we're going to get bits and we're going to put together that, putting together a list of pricing on what we're proposing. And this is where I say that this conversation, this discussion leads into the next one as well, because as we look at mitigation projects, some are very cheap. If I'm planting trees on hole 16, that's a rather inexpensive mitigation effort. It could be used so far as to install 25-foot nets adjacent to those called the line of homes that are repeatedly hit by drivers. That is also, in the grand scheme of things, probably relatively inexpensive. When we talk about the driving range, when we talk about some serious dollars, as Mr. Hart expressed, I believe the driving range study indicates that the fencing we currently have is in many ways inadequate and needs to be addressed. And we have some plans for that, and I'll get into this in the next discussion, but one of the big issues with the driving range study presented is that the caveat there is that it's designed to show the trajectory of balls hit by the top 10% of PGA Tour golfers, which last time I checked, 20 feet out was not using our driving range. So we're looking into how do we mitigate golf balls for golfers who are more human in how they approach the game of golf. And so I don't know how far you want to get into the driving range study right now, but. Yes. So the plan is that we put together a capital improvements plan, similar to what we do for the water sewer fund, similar to what we do for any parks master plan, and we say, here's what we want to do. Here's how we're going to get to where we feel like we need to be, or where we're mitigating the golf balls on a level that we're comfortable with the results. You know, and I think that there's multiple steps that need to be taken. I don't think the city's in a position to say, we're going to bite this all off at once. I think that there's got to be steps taken. And the driving range proposal is really one of this involves steps. You know, so I think that from a standpoint of being good neighbors again, we can show that While we can't do everything all at once, over time, we can do enough to correct this issue to where we feel like it's a non-issue.
Yeah.
So yes, there is a problem. That's a long answer for a short question.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the council?
I still have two things from the work session. And maybe we can do this out. But I still think 30 days for me is too long for windshields, unless we're just saying that we're giving people a little time to get used to the policy and that we're going to cover it. I feel like 30 days is just way too long to come back and say, I have to get 30 days ago driving down Canyon.
I agree, it's a long time. But going back to substantiating claims, I'm not really sure how you substantiate when a golf ball hit the windshield. That was going to be tough. So that's why I would say, no parent.
Yeah. And is there anything that we're going to be able to do? It just came to me that, especially when we start charging 50 cents at the dollar, I don't want that to be interpreted by golfers that we've absolved them of their responsibility.
I think we need the signs of saying you're still responsible for your ball. And when we get that initial call saying Mike Holmes been hit, Mike Carter been hit, the same practice that we've been doing right now is still pursued. And the, okay, well, wherever you're driving on Cannon Road, okay, odds are it was a full 16, let's send somebody from the pro shop out there. We still do make every effort to hold the golfer responsible. And I love hearing that a golfer actually approached your house. That is quite surprising, even though it's not direct travel. So that's really commendable to that golfer. But no, I think staff still does everything they can to find a responsible party.
And so you're saying if someone came and said I got hit 2 weeks ago, then that
obviously would be, we can't find them.
Right. And well, but that makes it harder for them to substantiate their claim too, right?
It really does.
You can't go out and say, well, there was nobody on hole 16.
So I mean, the language there, it says 30 days. Like I said, this code is really modeled after Murray's, where theirs is 60 calendar days. Now we can differentiate in saying that loss of personal property that's non-vehicular is treated differently in a timeline than a home loss. That's up to you how you want to approach that.
That's my suggestion.
Do you have a timeline you would be more comfortable with?
Like 14 days tops to me. I mean, I don't even know how they would substantiate they got hit. They come in and say, I got hit 2 weeks ago. What are you going to do? What the hiring are you going to do to prove that they did or didn't? Are you going to just say they did? They work for it?
I think it's very limited. Where were you driving? What time of day was it? You know, and then you must say that they said, oh, it was 2 weeks ago and it was 6 o'clock. Well, we came up 2 weeks ago and say, oh, well, it was thunderstorms 2 weeks ago and we didn't have any rain, of course. That's a part of it.
I think 14 days and 30 days is the same burden of proof for them to prove. I'm not sure it makes much of a difference. Like you say,
I personally agree. I like shortening the time frame. I really do.
For both home and car?
Not just both. I don't, you need more than 2 weeks.
So if that was me, I'd be right there. Most
people would. I think. From where I see it right now, anyway, is it may take some time for our residents to be aware that we have this policy. It's not something that's going to go out on their utility bill or whatever it be. So it's going to take some time for that word to spread. And so I would like to be a little bit more flexible. And frankly, I'd like to approach it from the opinion that we're not going to be taken advantage of by everybody out there. And if it turns out we're wrong and we are, then we need to reevaluate the policy. But I hate going to assuming that everyone in Utah County is going to look to try to take advantage of the situation.
And there's nothing that says that you can't reevaluate this policy in 2 weeks. I mean, if we immediately see something happening and changing, then we change it. This is one of the nice things about Title I is that we're not obligated to put this in a public hearing. You can just change what you need to.
This is a policy, it's not an ordinance.
This is an ordinance.
But the policy itself can be.
But it's under, because it's under Title I, we don't have to do a public hearing on this. So the time frame of getting changed if there's a problem is very short.
So, am I hearing right?
For now, because I think it's going to take some time. You know, Diane there may not know that we have this policy or may administrator says, oh, by the way, you know, that's you're doing this now, and it's three years later.
I don't think we're gonna get a rush. I mean, we just don't get that much damage out there.
And I would need for someone to come in and say, well, I didn't know, and you're telling me I didn't know 2 weeks ago, I'm just out. So I'd like to be a little bit more lenient to begin with, and if we feel like it's going in the wrong direction, then we need to push our eyes.
So it goes in the city newsletter, right? They get that in there, you tell me not everyone can be able to communicate about that. I agree, to see how that, what's going on. The only thing I would like to add is what we talked about in our session about the city's not going to pay for upgraded products.
Oh, yes.
Upgraded windshield, or, you know, we're gonna pick the comparable.
I think it's an appropriate place to add it would be under 114-6A, that goes in the floor for its, that same will only pay to replace that to upgrade. I'll work with the attorneys on the group there.
Is that in the same spot where it's specified that it should be the cost and not, you know, more, we're not making money on, it's not flat money. Not getting more than what the cost was.
That's another, the E one. Make sure that's included in the motion. Any other questions from the council? If not, someone wants to make a motion.
No, I will make a motion. I move that we approve ordinance 07-21-328, creating Title I, Chapter 11A, no fault golf ball claims subject to following amendment, adding that the city will pay to replace, not upgrade.
Could you also adopt the changes I discussed with the items?
And to add for private property damage to the verbiage in the ordinance. And the fixing of the misspelled words and numbers.
Motion made by Councilor Anderson. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Councilor Ellsworth. Councilor Geddes.
Aye.
Councilor Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilor Anderson.
Aye.
Councilor Smith.
Aye.
Councilor Miller.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Move on to item number 8, which is to review action on the golf course driving range trajectory study.
So here's the layout of our golf course. These are the initial elevations that you see out in the field, and and then this shows the profile view of the various golf balls being hit. This is a little bit difficult to see. I know it's very, the verbiage here is very tiny and it's almost impossible to read. But let me walk you through this. What you're seeing here is, here you see kind of the shape of the contours of the course of the driving range itself. But this is actually the berm. This is where the ball land. This is the berm where the fence sits. The where the balls land, or where we intend them to land, is actually a little bit lower. But then you see two different areas where the golf ball is being hit from. This goes back to, there's multiple areas where we have people teeing off at the driving range. So this study takes into account both of those locations. And this is what gives me a little bit of heartburn about this study here, is this note under 330. It says, it's designed to show what the top 10% PGA Tour player is doing when they hit the ball. And like I said, that is not, I think we can all agree that that is not who's at the track. To be brave, we're So anyway, this is the study, and it's, again, it's really difficult to read because these numbers are so small, but at 50, 90, and 50, 80, where the, that's the elevation where the tee-off's from, it's really about 50, 80. Our fences there sit on about, depending on where you are, you're looking at anything from about 8 to 12 foot berm and then 50 foot fence. So effectively, you have fencing that's anywhere from 58 to 62 feet in height. So what that does, looking at this trajectory of ball, that puts a fence that's right about here, right? So what we can see from the study is that we can't hold any PGA Tour events, but what we can see is that I think that there's areas of our driving range fence that are undersized. And I'd say that they're undersized in two ways, in that the height is undersized, but also the length. Our current fencing stops. It's really hard to see here, but you see these. They've designed a fencing scenario that wraps the entirety of the driving range. Well, our focus really is only on this south end here. I'm not in favor of putting any fencing very well. At least not the very top portion. But it's very fine, but if you zoom in on this, you can see where you can see these dots. These dots indicate where our current holes are. And you can see how far beyond you can see our dots end there, but this fencing goes on for quite a ways. This last dot is at about, I want to say 200 yards, probably 250. It's not very far, but there's still a great length of netting that should be out there. So I think that there's two areas where we need to address our netting situation. And this goes back to Councilmember Elsman's question of developing a long-term plan. I think that the length of the netting needs to be addressed, and I think in certain sections the height of the netting needs to be addressed. Now, I'll be frank. These holes here that are showing at 130 feet in height, they're not practical. We'll never put up 130 foot poles out there. If you look out the window there, you can see that those poles there are 50 feet. So imagine, you know, twice that and then some on top of that. That's what you'd be looking at. And quite frankly, we just can't do that. But also, I don't believe that the city should be designing a golf course driving range for the top 10% of PGA Tour golfers. We didn't design Harvard Park to be a Major League Baseball All-Star Game location. So there's limitations here. But when we look at what average golfers are hitting, and this is, I spent a lot of time this week and last week reading through articles online, but, and I'm not willing to go out and say this, go get bids on this, but it looks more like golfers are on average hitting their balls about 30 to 35 yards high. That's actually probably 30 to 32 yards high, which is about 95 feet. But with our current netting system, that's still short. So I think that there still needs to be some work done in terms of planning how the city does address this in the future. So with that being said, I think that the driving range would, as we look at this proposal, we recognize that we've got an issue here. And as Mr. R indicated in his comment, we are, as a staff, proposing that the driving range go to Ironmore Lane with certain caveats. One being that the drivers are allowed on turn mornings, so that would be about 7 o'clock. You allow drivers for about an hour. And typically, people playing tournaments are decent golfers, so they're not usually the ones that are hitting it like that. But also, that at any time the city were doing a study or trying to get more information about improving those nets, that we would allow people to allow drivers to kind of gauge, be able to do some studies and get more information. We look at certain items like radar trackers that allow you to kind of measures the speed of swing, the distance the ball travels, but the apex of what, how far, how high a ball goes is not really a typical number that golfers look at. They're looking at other metrics, they're looking at the angle of trajectory where it leaves the tee, they're looking at the loft of the driver, they're looking at the speed of the swing, they're not looking at how high the ball, they're looking at how far the ball goes. Getting good information on how high the balls are going is proving to be quite challenging. But with that being said, I think the information is out there. And I think there's things that we can be doing to get that information as we develop a long-term capital project plan for the golf course. But in the meantime, I think it's important to tell the council to say, okay, we recognize that there's some inefficiencies, here, but let's scale back the driving range to Arizona. I think So, like I said, we're meeting with some contractors on Thursday morning to talk about reshaping that tee box. And I'm getting some bids on what the cost of pushing that down into the ground is. We want to look at the possibility of taking some of our net holes here, removing them, adding them to the end of the driving range so that it addresses the length issue, and then looking at what's the cost to build up in those sections. Where we see the highest trajectory, the highest apex of the ball. So those are all part of the plan that we're developing with the golf course. I don't have that plan yet, but we're seeing for this. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Charlie, can you remind me, do we have an estimate of what Tanner Consulting's suggestion would cost?
It's $1.2 million.
So, the other thing I'm sorry, as much as I agree with this report that I would gratefully give to everybody, I will also express my disappointment that we expected that Tanner Consulting was going to come up with multiple options that we could look at and choose from instead of just one, and even after contacting him and asking him to provide some additional options with $1.2 million being way out of our budget, they denied that request.
So, can I just speak just to the golf course?
Please do.
So, I haven't really dug through the report, but I've read it, and honestly, this is the biggest sham I've ever seen. I think it's the biggest waste of money that we've ever spent. I think this guy should be ashamed of what he presented to us. I feel like he owes us a refund. Who in their right mind would ever recommend a net on the north side when you have a pond over there that with balls, either they go there, they never hit the 18th fairway, rarely, and I call it up to that. I'm just really disappointed. I mean, that's why I voted against it. I think it's a sham, and I think this guy should not be taken seriously. And I think going to irons only is just a cop-out. I think we're not a professional, we're not a PGA type of a golf course. We're a municipal golf course that's here for recreation and not training PGA future tour players. Although Tony Finau has played it on course. I've never seen him on the Iron Range. But I just don't think we need to give this report much credibility. And I go back to the question I asked at the last time we discussed this, and I asked how many people have been hit or hurt by a golf ball from the driving range. And I believe it was zero at that time. I think we've found out that there was maybe one person was hit since then in the lake on a ricochet. Mm-hmm. So I just think any amount of money we spend is just futile, wasted, useless. There are a lot of other things we can be doing in the city than spending money on the driving range to really protect nobody. Some property damage from I know there's some families that live there. But let's be honest, when they bought their lots, there were tons of golf balls on their lots when they bought their lots. So, I mean, call that harsh, but they knew they were golf balls. And that was when they nested 15 feet over. So I'm really disappointed. I mean, I voted against it, and I knew that something like this would. They didn't do what we asked. I mean, we were asking for other solutions, and they just come with a big net that's taller than that Riverside Country Club net down in Provo. That's 100 feet. And we're not a country club. We're a municipal public golf course that provides great entertainment for 38, 40 bucks a round. And it's a credit to our staff for having a phenomenal year and doing so much with so little so little funds that they've made our course. And honestly, this year has been phenomenal. I talked to a lot of people when I golf. I haven't golfed a lot this year, but when I go out there, I try to get people's opinions and things. And we're just getting a great reputation in the Valley. It's a great course to play. It's a reasonable course. And it just bugs me that we would even consider wasting money. I agree to make a few minor things, but let's concentrate on getting our course. It's great for the budget, but there's things that we can do that are a lot more productive than a stupid net that has not, nobody has ever been hurt other than one person who got hit in the leg, as I understand it. So that's my 2 cents. Fire away.
I agree with some of that. I agree that this study is kind of useless to me. And it's useless to me because of the scope of what you did by basing this on the PGA. This study, in my mind, has no ability to the actual usage of our courts. And that's what I was really hoping to see is, what is a recreational golfer? What is their trajectory? I was hoping to see some sort of scatter chart of where these things go. This didn't live up to any of that. So really, really disappointed in the fact that this doesn't tell me anything. I can't use the data that you put together to make any sort of policy decision. Once again, we're going to be doing best effort, and I think the best effort is probably the right way to go. Let's look at what the extending the net is in Grayfoot. That's fine with me. But we don't have the science still to back it up because it was based on the wrong data set. That's my thing that I come from a very technical data set minded view of this statistics, and in my case this isn't valid.
Let me just add this comment. I don't disagree with your frustrations because when I saw this, I need to get on the phone with anyone. Why are we assuming that we're trying to keep it PGA Tour level events? I asked for, I emailed them and I asked for profiles showing what an average golfer accumulates in this course. You showed me this information, and the response was, this is the information that courses pull out, so this is what you get. And I'm really disappointed, and I get that. So it's frustrating to walk away from the study, and this is the result, because quite frankly, to me, the results here are, I can't build that. I can't propose to you build that. I can't, in good faith, come to you and say, hey, this costs $1.2 million, but it keeps every range ball in the driving range for a range that makes $20,000 a year. I mean, by the time my grandkids are 70, it'll be paid for.
For $1.2 million, I'm sure we could build an indoor range.
For cheaper than that, actually.
For cheaper, yeah. That would be able to be used
on your ground.
And it would be driver friendly.
So then to me, Governor Ellsworth, I approached it in a very similar manner, saying, I can't use this data. This data is not helpful in designing a solution to this golf course or to this mending system. And that's why I've been spending a lot of time reading about What is your average golfer? What does that trajectory look like? But it's increasingly difficult to find information on the apex of the golf ball, because that's a factor that is not important to golfers. How high the ball goes is not important to golfers. It's how far your ball goes. How fast am I swinging the club to get it there? So it's very infrequent that we're not seeing good information on the height of the ball. I spent the last 2 days looking at, I feel bad for Greg because every time I get an idea, I call him. So he has to take my calls. But, you know, there's these, I'm sure you've seen them, Councilman Guest, they basically just track your swing. And they kind of store the data points on how fast your swing was and how far the ball goes. Very few of them actually will tell you how high the ball goes, but it's basically a radar tracker that says, here's how your ball is hit.
So if you watch golf much,
little,
they do show the tracker now, they show the apex and the height. That is, they show it on TV now, so maybe more people are concerned about their trajectory.
But again, the average stats I've seen on TV are PGA tour hits.
Right, they're tour players.
So, that'd be like I said, that'd be like designing Harvey Park outfield fencing based on what I saw in the home run derby. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So the thought was, well, and we're still exploring, this is still in its infancy. That's why I say, here's the problem, I don't quite have a solution yet, but here's a temporary solution. But looking at some of these trackers and saying, well, what if we were allowed to do some driver, to use drivers with these trackers and start to build that data set, build that science to say, here's what's happening at our golf course. And then coming back with the netting system proposal saying, here's what's actually happening, here's where it's happening, here's how we fix it. And like I said, this idea is still in its infancy, but it doesn't result that it needs time to grow and it needs time to get there. But in the meantime, we still have an issue, and that's hence the recommendation to go to Irons Only. I know it's not a recommendation that anyone on staff is jazzed about, but I mean, quite frankly, we'll do whatever the council wants. But
what difference does it make not being a golfer using irons versus drivers?
Good question. Now, this is the study we did. And I apologize because the numbers will change because it's just the spreadsheet set up that way.
Are we still tracking that?
No, and I think that's why you're seeing a lot of golf all the way, because we're not making any of the game up.
Because the numbers have been picked up for weeks, right?
It's been a week or two.
Real quick, just to say.
They're picked up daily. I don't believe they're already picked up daily now.
They pick up as best they can, but they're not doing the detailed thing they did before.
Just to answer your question about the difference between woods and irons. With the driver, it is a different swing, it's a different stance, and it's a different way to warm up. So that's why I like to do that on the driving range. It takes a lot of warming up to get your swing right. The irons, it's just a different swing. So,
that makes the ball take differently.
It's going to be a different type of shaft on the club, different feel for how you're trying to hit it. Sometimes with irons, you're really not trying to. You're trying to be more precise on where you want that ball to go. The driver, you're trying to get it out there from the iron to finish.
So
obviously the drivers hit a lot longer. So you're trying to there's longer club changes so much between those two, but it's a longer club, it has degenerates longer club head speed, and it just goes farther because it's got a big head, it's got a mass behind this.
Different golf clubs are designed to address different situations right now, so drivers meant to hit as far as you can and ideally straight. The irons have lock on them, so the ball can go higher, but it doesn't go quite so far. They angle a lot differently on the irons to address the various situations of where you are on the course, what's in front of you. Whether it's a river, whether it's a tree. But that's kind of the basic idea. But we did track it, and and I recognize that this isn't, there's a big margin of error here, so it's, we're trying to get a good idea of what the number of golf, we want to get this in, what the golf balls were doing in terms of leaving golf course. This first column here is the number of balls picked up on the golf course side of the house, anything on that hillside. Quite frankly, I'm not concerned with it, it would be the city property. So this first column is the golf balls picked up on the fence, but not still on city property. This is how many balls were picked up on the south side of the property, just whether it's in the street and beyond. And then these next three columns kind of give us an idea of how much on the balls we hit during the day. Small baskets, large baskets, and employee buckets, which we're assuming are large buckets. Small baskets have 31 balls, large baskets have about 62 balls, so using that information, you can kind of extrapolate the estimate of how many balls are being hit that day. And then we're saying, okay, what's the total number of balls going over the net? That's both of these columns. What's the percentage of balls going in the net off the property? That's the percent, this percentage of that number. And then we recognize that we're not collecting every ball. Kids walk by, balls roll down the hill, they go into the storm drain system, they get picked up by passersby, or they just don't find them. And so we're recognizing that and trying to add in a randomized margin of error for this number will change as I adjust the spreadsheet. And given that, that number is added to this percentage of balls going over the net off property, and then we're getting a rough percentage here. You can see the first couple of days were very high because we hadn't been picking the balls up the day, a couple of days before. But once we started picking the balls up, it actually is very consistent in that it's about 1 to 2%. And so these different weeks, each one of these colors represents a 2 week period. At different locations, blue area, purple on here, but this area here, this is irons only from the lower tee box. Green, I believe, is irons and drivers allowed from the lower tee box. Then you go to this pink, red-ish color. That's irons only from the upper tee box, and then finally, yellow is irons only and for irons and drivers from the upper tee box. We did have to close the driving range for a number of days. So we try to take that into account, but this number here, this is on average, we saw 1.9% of balls leaving for irons and drivers only for the upper tee box. In the upper tee box and irons only, we saw 1.1%. And so, like I said, if I were to change this, if I were to adjust the spreadsheet in any way, shape, or form, if I added this as a 10, it's going to recalculate all that. So it changes a little bit, but. The numbers stay fairly consistent that they're about 1.2%, 1%, but and then overall we see about this number changes anything from 1.1 to 1.3%. Now even if you triple the number of golf balls that we're not capturing, it's still the number is about 2 to 3% that are going over. It's a small percentage, but I think the mayor made this point a few meetings ago when a small percentage of a large number could still be the number that they're uncomfortable with. And that's where we are.
Will you do me a favor on each of those colors? Will you tell me how many balls were on the south side by color?
Sure. In the blue, which was irons only on the lower tee box, we saw 119. On the green, which was irons and drivers on the lower tee box, we saw 164. On the pink, which is irons only from the upper tee box, we saw 173. And then irons and drivers from the upper tee box, we saw 138. That obviously can't take into account that there's 3 days there that driving range is closed. Also, you start to really see a difference in golf course activity from these early days down into these days. And that's why we're trying to do it based on a percentage, not necessarily the number of balls. Felt like it was more accurate representation.
Sure. But to that point, like last time, it's helpful to know 2% is 173 balls in a 2 week period of time.
I have a question maybe for Greg. What would be the downside of us going to this policy?
To which one? Irons Only?
Yeah.
I'll be frank, we're going to do what you tasked us to do, like we always do. We will become a laughing stock of golf courses. I think golf courses can speak for that. But we're going to do it. We need to do it. The downfall is the tee boxes you're going to see get torn up really bad. Because golfers with irons, they don't use a tee, so all they're doing is taking divots constantly. So we'll be rotating that quite often. It's going to do some damage there, which is expected when you do irons. Just the one point that Mr. Hart brought up too about aiming the tees to the left. I personally would say absolutely not, because we had so many complaints from golfers on 18 that just barely got missing out by turn. Because now we're aiming right at them saying, let's not hit the deep on the road yet. Let's hit those golfers over there. So there's, you can find a medium ground and make everybody happy, but what we're going to do is we tell us to do. But that's just, be honest.
That's my concern. I don't want to hurt the brand. And I also don't want to, now we're incurring another cost that we didn't have before, either by having less people who want to come to golf here or by repairs to the tee box. So I don't think it's as simple as it looks on here where it just says, let's go to irons. You know, there's some negatives.
And from our perspective, just so you understand, we will lose revenue. Because once they know that word gets out, Fox Hall is going to be very, very happy because they're going to get everyone over there, but we're going to lose it. And again, to Chad's point, we don't make a ton off of the driving range, but it's going to be nice.
That's not a revenue source. Like,
right.
It's huge. It's not going to affect our budget much. It's just going
to... No, will they not come here at all, right?
Yeah, it affects the quality of our course as far as the perception of, you know, the average ball that wants to play.
And remember,
I think that will lose green fee revenue.
Yes.
If there will be some reciprocal with the Los Angeles revenue, yes.
Do we know what that looks like?
I don't think we can properly anticipate people's reaction to that. I'm not sure.
They're going to be upset.
When we went to Irons those 2 weeks, each time when somebody came in and we told them that, they just gave us the dirty look, turned around and left, and said, we won't be back. And it's to be expected. I get that. Golfers, they don't want to do that. That's not ideal for them. But, you know, for the study, we did it, and it's fine. We'll go to that, we'll do it. You can tell us what to do.
Right. For us, for a short amount of time, they'll do that. They'll give you a dirty look and leave. But then, if it becomes our policy, they're going to tell everybody that we don't allow drivers.
And you'll get iron, as you can see, you're going to still get irons over there. You know, people can take a 7-8 iron and get over that. If you really want to, they're going to do it.
Yeah, very correct. The trajectory of the iron is, the height is the same with the driver. It's just not the apex is much closer to where the initial hit occurred rather than further away. It's just a little different.
So irons isn't going to mean zero balls. Just like, I have to say too, I was really disappointed in the 72 because I think they were all excited and anticipating 15, 16 different great ideas to creative solutions. And what I saw was a bubble that said, well, if you put it all in, you know, if you put a net over the top of it, then yeah, nothing will get out. So I was really unhappy with that too. But I mean, if we're not talking about zero balls, I'm hesitant to do anything that's going to really hurt the brand and make it where people don't want to come here at all. And that could be, we could see that go out so far that we're talking about a lot of crazy.
Oh, yeah. So then, I guess my point is at some point the council has to make a decision. And this is where I really work. You guys need to make a good decision. If you choose to not do anything, there's a cost. If you choose to do something, there's a cost. And each one has a different reciprocal action by staff and by the residents. And so if you say, look, we're going to go to irons only, under the presumption that there will be zero balls going over the fence, I mean, we're still living in a fantasy world. There will still be golf balls going over the fence, and they will still be a problem. If you go to drivers, leave it as it's been for 16 years, you haven't done anything to address the issue. And then you have to ask yourself, go to the next logical step, what are we going to do to address the issue? At that point, then, to me, it becomes a greater imperative to have an honest, frank conversation about the timeline of adjusting any of the debts and saying, how committed are we to this? And that accelerates that decision and saying, okay, well, let's get a couple of lending companies out here to give us a bid on this. Let's do that. Rather than making an iron dome. This is all for you guys to make a call on. We can come back and say, we've reached out to a number of lending companies, this is what the cost is, and this is what you can expect. This is how we can propose to pay for it, but there's going to be reciprocal issues in that it's not cheap, and you're drawing down on city finances in a very uncertain financial time.
And I would just add, his writing is so small here, he does say in here, and I think it's something that we as a golf course owner need to acknowledge. He says, new technology is constantly improving golf equipment, and with that fact, players will have an increased ability to hit the ball further and higher. To me, it means we can't expect that the problems that we had in 2005 are going to be the same problems we have in 2020. But the reality is that golf equipment is becoming more efficient and allowing for more balls to go over the fence. We just can't say, well, not that's not a problem. We have to acknowledge that the course wasn't built to handle golf clubs of 2020 when it was built in 2005. There just has to be some acknowledgement.
And I agree. If you want to just continue reading that at the end of that paragraph, it says a minimum recommendation to consider would be the ability to increase the ball height in any by 10%. So what he's saying, a minimum, you know, 5 feet, the 50 feet now, 10% is 5 feet.
Right. Yeah, I agree. The 130 feet option is ridiculous, but I also don't think we can say technology has gotten better, more balls going over the fence, and that's not our issue.
And then, you're right. And then further on down here, I'm really disappointed that he doesn't even acknowledge the golf balls we use, which are Schrickson restricted flight rain balls, and he uses a Spalding super rain ball. So I don't know the differences, but I don't think it's the same. Is it rare?
Very, very little, to be honest with you. In fact, the Schrickson one we use is the one that's recommended in the driving ranges.
And it's a much better. I mean, I hit that Schrickson like 20 yards shorter than a regular golf ball on like a 7 iron.
I mean, it's working.
It works.
So I like Chandler's idea of, I agree with all of you, that the data we see from Tech Consulting is not helpful because of the things that they're assuming is not accurate for all golfers. It sounds like what we need to do is to continue to collect data specifically for us, and staff's going to know better than I do about how to go about doing that. And so the question that I think staff is asking is, while we're going through that process, what do we do in the meantime? Nothing or something, even though it makes a minimal impact, or it's something completely different than irons only. And like I said, I mean, we could staff the driving range for the entirety of the hours and have somebody out there making sure that if golf balls go over, that we tell them you need to go.
A lot of children raising nets.
I'm saying it doesn't have to be irons only. It doesn't have to be raising the nets. It could be. We can still look at other options.
Everything's on the table right now.
Yeah. But I want us to acknowledge that the course that was built in 2005 is facing different issues now than it did back then, just because of the technology announcements.
Well, it's going to continue to change too.
Sure.
So we have to fix for what we're dealing with now, maybe different in 5 years from now. So I don't really be chasing it. Like, how? What are we going to do?
I have just a couple more thoughts. And even in his study, if you look at that too, he even says that at 120 feet, you're still not going to prevent ball from going over.
Yeah, he says.
That's something you have to think about too.
He says something about 130 feet still won't keep every ball from going over.
So, and the other thing too, I think the biggest issue, they're still going to get balls over the net. That, there's no question about that. Our biggest issue is the loss on the length of the range. Balls are just scooped right through the end of that right now. So I think my opinion is we just need to extend that longer and turn it in, hit those balls and knock it back down into the range.
Yeah, if anyone wants to get a proposal for that, I'm all for getting, looking at ideas and putting costs to them before we make any comments.
But as Chandler mentioned too, we're doing Thursday for a project potentially at the driving range to lower that. I think that could be a really good
idea. I think that's a good thing. I mean, we could easily do that idea.
I think that's a win for both sides.
Well, if you look at T-Box, all those where you can kind of see the two areas that you can see off from. You can see these little bits that you can make. feet off from. So that's part of the project is to take this whole, see this whole area here and push it down to the ground. This part would be about 10 to 12 feet. This part would be about 5 to 7 feet. And it'd be at the same elevation. We're shooting for about the same elevation as this right here. What that does is that you're effectively raising the nets by pushing the area of your team off from down to the ground. Now that's my, well, this is my opinion, so I'll take it for that. But that's all part of the problem. You still have, by what I can see, my limited research, is that 90 feet is a sweet spot for municipal dollars, 30 yards. And I don't think that's 30 yards for the duration of the netting. I think it's 30 yards for where people are. An average drive of about 220 yards with these rain balls, that's a pretty solid hit. And saying where's the apex on that drive, and saying those are the nets that we need to raise. You know? And I've talked to some of you about this in the past, often in some different time, but these poles are only there engineered to go up another 20%, so they can go up 10 more feet. But that doesn't get us to where we want to be. We're looking at that 30-yard apex as a pressure. And I'm saying that, keep in mind, limited research. So in order to do that, I would say identify the poles that you think, where we can identify where the apex of the ball is, and say we're going to replace that section of poles. We're going to take those poles, add those onto the, extend this out, probably out to here and then beyond this utility road, and then these sections of poles install, you know, 7 to 8 foot netting that will then be treated with the ground being punched down lower as effectively the 30 yards that we're looking at. And that's just based off of what I said, limited research. So that's kind of where staff is going in terms of an idea.
I mean, I guess this is all coming up to the front. Since this has come up, I've kind of had a and to look at other ranges and things. And I did notice that would you actually have to replace those poles or just add to them?
Well,
the 20 or 30 feet.
They're only engineered to go up another 10 feet. Now, that kind of surprised me, even if they're still poles. Something that I hadn't considered that brought my attention was that while they look big and robust, the actual thickness of the wall inside may be thinner, and that's why you can only go up another 10 feet. So if you're going to get a pole that is of a thicker gauge there and install those ones, then you can, going back to Councilman Ragsdale, to your point, plan for the future in that they're then engineered to go higher when you need to.
What are they? I mean, they're buried in concrete, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're not going to reuse them if you tear them out, are you? Are you going to be able to chip around and get them out?
We try to reuse them. I think they're worth reusing. And even, honestly,
even if you take the ones, if you lose some,
even if you
cut it,
cut it the base there, and I go bury it on hole 16 and I solve that problem with it,
yeah,
it's still useful.
Yes.
And we're not deciding on that.
No.
I just want to reiterate, these are just possible solutions that staff is going to come up with.
We've tried throwing everything in the fridge, seamless sticks, and so some ideas are better than others.
I mean, I looked at this section quick. There's so many things that I think we need to know more about to just table this.
So, well, my question real quick, when does the season end?
Two and a half months, probably.
October. Okay. So, if the council feels like they need more information before they can make a decision, we definitely can't table it if you'd like. I just would like the council to start thinking, with 2.5 months left in the season, is there something we should do while staff is doing this research to come up with awesome solutions? And if you don't know where you're going to make a decision tonight, that's okay.
Now, keep in mind this as well, that the motion tonight is only for this season.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't see where you support this motion as is because of the implications of what it will do. I agree with Mike. I think it just absolutely just needs to be tabled. We need real information, and it looks like you guys are already moving down that path, which
Please note, just even though we don't have a paid person there that can police it, our marshals now that we have every day from 9 o'clock till 8 at night, every time they're doing their turns, they're coming by and they're looking at that. So they're looking for issues too that they can address. So if they see somebody causing a problem down there, we address it.
Would you say they're doing that more than they have in the past?
Absolutely.
Indirectly.
Yeah, the marshals never used to do that, so.
In order to get better information, there could be the need to expend some money. And I say that because, like I said, Greg and I have been talking about these range trackers, show where it falls in the end. In order to do something like the city, we have to purchase a few of these trackers and say, hey, let's set these out there and see where balls are going. In order to get good information, because I would hate to spend money only to have 2 years later come someone come back and say, this isn't adequate. I would expect that whatever solution we come up with is adequate for a good period of time. I'd say 10 to 15 years. But I mean, the range is an asset to the course, and what we do down there affects the course energies and perception. And we've come a long way in how people perceive our golf course, but I do think that there needs to be something done.
And I also want to acknowledge, maybe as a point of advocate, that it's not just one perception. It's not just the perception that golfers have of the course. It's the perception that all the residents have of the course. And if there are issues that residents feel like we're not resolving or that we're ignoring, it becomes a very divisive issue in our community, and we have to weigh that cost as well.
Which goes back to the previous item, in that I think we've really catered to golfers over the years, and we've really improved that relationship, but at what cost? And so I might kind of go there, our next door neighbors to say, what do you hear? So I don't have answers on what solutions are right now. Because the hardware equipment, yes, it's a solution, it's not a solution the city can afford.
I wish there was a solution today, but there's not. And I'm happy to take time to find the right solution to make a long lasting, hopefully, solution to this problem. I don't know that going to irons is the solution.
I agree.
I would like to make a motion to be able to cite.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Geddes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to item number 9, which is a review action on extending the deadline for registering accessory dwelling units, accessory apartments.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor and Council. 2 years ago, we adopted a program that allowed recognize the existence of accessory dwelling units in the city, and it was a part of the plan to develop a moderate income housing plan for our general plan that was state rules. There is a limitation on what the city can do in order to adopt moderate income housing or create a moderate income housing plan, just given our demographics, given our build-up, given some other similar situations that we face that we need. One of the things we did was we created this accessory apartment code. And apartment code was it created a 2-year deadline for people to register their existing apartments, after which there would be a penalty imposed of $500. We are approaching that deadline on July 31st is when that deadline hits. And given everything that's happened in the city and in the community, country, it's been as far as we want. Staff is recommending as however you want, but a matter of trying to work with residents on this issue that we extend this deadline to the end of this fiscal year, so June 30th, 2021, at which point we would be imposing this fine on those that have existing unregistered accessory dwelling units.
I have a question really quickly about moderate income housing requirements. Is the city penalized if people don't register their
divisions? No. The city's not, let me back up. The city, as part of its moderate income housing plan, adopts a number of policies or ordinances that show to the state that we are doing our part to help with the housing crisis that's kind of along this process. There's a lot of things that cities can do. They have a
then they call it a menu, and in the code, it's, you know, you can apply for certain grants, and you can apply for excess funding, but really the penalty comes down to you won't be eligible for certain state funds. And they're not really clear on that. It could be classified as a road fund, it could be sales tax penalties, and the state legislature has shown a willingness to get into city portions of sales tax in recent years in order to help alleviate housing issues, specifically the homeless issue. But as far as a strict penalty directed to the city, the village register, ADU is no.
But I want to add that moderate income housing is in its infancy. So this year what the state said is, here are 18 options, and in order to qualify for TIF funding or TTIF funding, you have to choose and implement at least three of them. There was no requirement that we had to show that it actually had an impact. But the Housing Coalition, that was the group formed by the state legislature, is heavily influenced by housing affordability advocates. And one of the things that they're saying is the state legislature didn't go far enough. And so the discussion at some point will be, did this actually have an impact? And if not, what are you going to do to fix that? And if not, here's what the penalty is going to be. And they just spin out all sorts of things, like withholding class B and zero funds was an example that was thrown out. Financially, that would be very painful for us if we stopped using, we stopped receiving B and zero funds because we didn't have enough affordable housing. And there is a valid argument on both sides of how much can we really influence affordable housing, because we can't tell people how much their rent they're being used for. And the state pushing that we need more affordable housing because it has become too expensive to live. So right now, no, we're not penalized, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in the future we are.
Let me add this. I'm going to commend Mary Reese because she's been very good advocate for the city in terms of helping the legislature recognize that their one-size-fits approach for this problem does not work for cities. When our demographics are vastly different from other communities in our area, we share a zip code with a city that is vastly different than its demographics. So you can't approach the problem and say you both have the same possible solutions. Mary Reese has been very instrumental, I think, in working with the legislature and informing them of trying to see different ways of approaching this problem.
Sorry, I probably sidetracked this from the real issue here, which is I agree in extending the deadline.
So, that's a good question. We'll understand why this matters, right? Like, why does it matter that we have this ordinance for trying to get as many people to register as possible,
right? And one other question. What do we require of people who rent out their whole homes? So if I left and rented my whole house out,
We used to require a business license. It was back in 2015 and 16, state legislature changed the business license requirements. So we scrapped that, and that it didn't meet the threshold of having an impact on the neighborhood. It should just be the same as what you did with the design plans. So there's really no lot to do when it comes to renting homes.
We do have the rule, though, that you have to live in the home in order to rent.
Yes. And you can't have it. Right. You know, it has to be.
You can't rent both levels out, for example.
Yes.
Okay.
Is it clear? Because Provo has an issue. Like, there is an AD and you're renting the house. You have to. I mean, can you still rent to the family members? I mean, if you live upstairs.
Yes. That's not even considered. That's not even considered a rental. As long as you're in the same family unit, you can find a family unit in your code. We don't even consider it, even though it could be a totally separate unit.
We talk about, I can't remember, I think we had this suggestion, but we talk about what the relation has to be
in a unit. Yes.
Weren't you on the planning commission when the definition of a family took like 2 years?
It's all coming back now.
It was a long
one. So it is in there, isn't it?
It was a long discussion of what does a family mean?
Right, okay, yeah. Now I remember.
Oh.
So that would be interesting.
It has to be at least
one degree of separation.
Family. There's different kinds. Hold on. One of the following groups of individuals, but not more than one at the same time. A, so there's, I think, four different types of families. A, an individual living alone. B,
two or more people, all of whom are related to one designated occupant of the dwelling by blood marriage, adoption, or legal guardianship, and their foster children, and up to two other unrelated persons who do not pay rent or give other consideration for the privilege of staying with the family. C, up to, this is the college home, but up to four unrelated individuals who live together as a single housekeeping unit, or D, two unrelated individuals and any children, either of them living as a single housekeeping unit. A guest under this section is defined as a person who stays with the family for a period less than 30 days within any dwelling, one year period, and is not utilized the dwelling as a legal address for any purpose. I think that kind of goes to that question.
Okay.
This has come up as an issue of discussion because, quite frankly, how you define a family can really cause some serious issues legally for the city if you're not doing it correctly. And I'm in no way, shape, or form going to say that the city is. We've had issues with this code before, and it's been a few years, but it may be something that we need to look at and review.
It might be, yeah.
So we've tried to be very lenient in terms of in interpreting it broadly rather than more narrowly. So when we have a group of individuals living together and they're all paying rent, when we say living together as a single housekeeping unit, that's how we're interpreting it, that they're all contributing to the mortgage and to the rent. It's not just in one person's ability. So we try to be very broad in our interpretation of this.
And frankly, that singular occupancy also helps us with our monitoring process.
Yes. Yes, the single.
Yeah, because you've got four single people living in the house, paying
$300 a month.
Or you have another one, or the other one, or the other one.
Exactly. But the trick with our current code is that someone who legally owns the home has to also live there.
If it's right? An accessory dwelling unit?
Yeah.
Yes, it has to be owner occupied.
But under number four, the four unrelated individuals know they can all be renting individual rooms in that house.
Right, but the owner still has to also live there.
No, that was like a pure rental of the whole house.
That's the whole house. That's the whole house. Okay, that's not that they can. Because I know that the home that I live in now was they were renting those floors and had been renting properties why they sold their home because they lived in Florida and wanted to rent out the top floor to one family and the bottom floor to another family. And that
did it for you guys.
That we don't allow.
That is not allowed.
Okay, that's what I wanted to understand.
And we have had that issue come up a few times.
And I just wanted to reiterate what I said during the work session. I'm fine to do the extension with the current situation we're in. I don't think it's really hard to register your ADU though. So I know that people are maybe a little stressed out right now, a little preoccupied, but I don't think we've made the hoops very hard to jump. We haven't made them expensive. So I'm fine with the extension as long as it's the last extension and you start putting some teeth to this so that we get people to register so that we and mitigate some of those problems we might have with the state.
It has been my experience that the toughest hoop to jump through doesn't hurt everyone, but it does occur when they realize that they don't have any occupancy limits. That is when they run into the biggest issue. But it's not.
In the original construction.
But that is not something that can't be overcome. Okay. In fact, many people have.
And I agree with everything you just said, but I will also say when it comes to arguing with the state, the more that we can show, we eliminated impact fees, we had this period of time where they registered and no registered without being fined, whatever the case is, it builds our case to say, we have made it so easy and we still only have 10% registered, what more can we actually do? And so it helps strengthen our argument when it comes to not meeting our affordable housing requirements that we've done so much trying to make it easy. It's a lot of them will say, cities make it so hard that it's so difficult. And I know a lot of cities refuse to compare their impact fees, and so let's say it's too expensive, it's too difficult, there's too many hoops. The more we can show we try to make this easy as possible, the better it will be for us
and I like that, I agree with that.
So I totally agree, and as a general contractor myself, I feel like there are not too many things that some of the things was done, as we talked about in the work session, should be grandfathered. Well, there are too many things that can't be safely driven. I mean, we talked earlier about electrical. There are some issues with maybe egress and better than, you know, where you can't.
This is the big issue.
Yeah, where you can't get
the window doesn't be the right size for egress. But simple things like smoke detectors of carbon monoxide by the bedrooms, the things that are, you know, if they're gonna rent their house for their accessory dwelling unit for several hundred a month, those are things that can be easily taken care of and make the house safe for people that are going to rent. So I have no problem. I like putting heat in it. I think it's time to just say, you know what, get a register.
Well, and another thing that I talked to some of the legislators about is, and I don't say this is the majority, but there are some people who I've heard from who just say, it's none of the government's business if I don't have it. So I'm not going to register because I don't want it documented. Now, I would come to overcome that. Because we're not going to know that the less than a nuisance complaint, we can somehow tie it to this nuisance is strictly tied to the ADU, otherwise we're not going to be able to do
that. Well, I think that's why we have it, though. I know. Again, my home in St. George that we nightly rent, they can make us have a business license. And the only way they come at us is if there's a problem. And then they come and say, where's your business license? And then the fine is $1,000. So I think that without those things in place, we don't have a way to mitigate maybe some other issues that those that can use might cause in the neighborhoods. We've got to have something that we can say, you've got to have something when you're going to be impacting the neighbors. And possibly.
I agree. I don't think we need to be the nanny police, you know, but let's try to get, I don't know, keep it active in our newsletter, keep it whatever, keep it out there so people understand that, you know, there's going to be some consequences. Like, it's not a big deal to do this.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, again, one other area, the only difference is that, like a nightly rental in St. George, you don't really get complaints from neighbors about their basement renters, because...
Not typically, no.
Yeah, and so it's not some...
Well, like, they live there. I mean, if you live there, saying they're making sure there's people not around.
Right. So even eventually when we put teeth in it, and I agree we should, I don't think it will result in all of a sudden we have a bunch of ADUs being registered, because we're not going to still know. Right. Because people aren't complaining about it.
Just education,
let them
know there's some easy steps or whatever, I don't know, or click on this link
and
see
what you can do. And the big one for us is explaining to them the public safety aspect. It's good for our fire department to know we have people registered. So if they call, the fire department is aware that there are two separate households in that unit. And so we really try to push that as well as explaining the public safety.
So just came to mind. So I just finished a house in Buzzard Grove that had an accessory unit. And the city actually made us put the address and the letter A.
We do that.
We do that.
We wanted to do it right up there in the round.
Yeah. It's already enormous. Okay, sorry, that was a good conversation. We got a lot of
things
done. All right, who wants to make a motion?
I'll make a motion. To authorize staff to extend the deadline to register an accessory dwelling units through the end of the 2021 fiscal year.
Motion made by Councilmember Gittins. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. It's not Gittins. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. So we have item number 10, which is a discussion on the citywide fiber project. So while Chairman's deployment at council, I asked for this to be a discussion item on our agenda. We had Toby and come present this survey that's in all the information in your packet. And I told Chandler before we go out and submit an RFP, as recommended by Roger, I'd like to know first from the council whether you have the appetite for this particular project. I will start off by saying, those of you who have worked with me for a long time know that I'm fairly risk averse. So I'm a little concerned having to receive a 40% take rate?
40%.
40% take rate within 5 years. If we don't get to that point, then we have to be ready to commit city funds to make the difference, which I don't think we do without a tax increase. And so as much as I dislike my internet provider and would love a better and faster option, I'm also a bit hesitant about the risk.
Let's talk about that. That's you just like what we do in the group.
So why what?
Define why we've got to do this. Just because everybody I talk to says I don't like my provider buttons.
So I'm using his presentation he gave, the Roger term he gave in last council meeting. This is his slide. You can see that the restructure is set up so that you're paying $65 a month, and that is the $30 a month for infrastructure, and you can see that goes towards your debt service and then $35 for utility operations and maintenance. And I want to add this caveat before I go any further, that anything I say is off back then now in that calculation without seeing actual financing documents and how many what take rate actually needs to be, we can only assume what they show is accurate. So this is, you see that this financial model that you presented, you have a bond that has delayed principal payments where you have 2 years where you're not making any payments, and then it's just truly during that 2 years you are signing people up. So that's kind of the basic 40% in there that you're assuming that. Before this first bond payment kicks in and you're in month 24, you want to be able to have this reserve. So the difference between this orange line and this blue line is your reserve, your financial reserve. You want this section of the graph to be bigger than this section of the graph. So when this crossover happens, you have the reserves to pay this shortfall. Now the question is, how long is this shortfall occurring? Now, they have a pretty steep curve here. But if you have a pretty shallow curve, you're in trouble. And I think that's what the mayor is alluding to. So let's go into some, like I said, math and calculations. They gave us a number of $6.25 million to do the project. That includes a connection throughout the entirety of the city. It does not include connections to our border of Pleasant Grove. So those homes do not show any improvements adjacent to them. Now, if you were to extend this, if you're going to move forward with the project and extend it to them and say, there's a possibility you could be a Cedar Hills resident in the near future or far future, we want to make sure that this service is offered to you. Yeah, it goes towards our take rate, but it also increases the bond. So you have to keep that in mind. But they're saying bond total is $6.25 million, and am I following this? It's a little bit above $35,000, so I'm saying, let's say that your monthly bond payment is equal to $36,000. 40% take rate. Based on what I find, we have, and this just seems right to me, Cedar Hills households, 2,318. 40% of that is 927 households. 40%, 927 times the 30, which is the previous slide here, times this 30 to meet your debt service, doesn't get you to the 36. So you still have to have those institutional sign-ups, which is the churches and schools in commercial areas. And we are very limited in those areas. We have the two other grade schools, and obviously we discussed one peak, signing one peak, that would be a very beneficial contract with this to move forward. Then you have a limited commercial area. You know, I don't know if the storage unit needs high-speed internet. I don't know if SWIG needs high-speed internet. Walmart probably would want it. Chase Bank would probably want it, but I can't speak for them. We have seven churches in the city, and I don't know where they are at on signing up their buildings for this service to go. So, as far as institutional users, I don't know what our take rate would be there. We'd love to get them all because they're such a move to the underlying debt finance requirements, but we just don't know. But in order to get to that $36,000, you actually need like 1,200 homes, which is about half. So this is why I'm saying back in the napkin, don't quote me on being employees, you can't quote me. But without having some real finance numbers and really seeing what the project's all about, this is where the RFP is important. But you don't know, but that take rate is very high. But based on that $36,000, if you're you know, 5% short, that's an annual shortfall of the bond payment of about $21,600. And when you just look at budgets, you kind of know not a lot of, not a profit. So finding $21,000 in this year's budget is very challenging. With that being said, so I'm giving you the doom and gloom. You look at some of these other cities, and I appreciate that you showed some of these other take rates for these other communities.
There was another one showing.
Linden has a 57% take rate. One of the cities that he mentioned was Gordon. So I reached out to their city manager because Roger expressed that they would have the RFP. So I reached out to their city manager and he generously provided their RFP. But I asked a follow-up question saying, what were your internet connection, what were your internet options prior to Utopia? And not thinking they were very good, and I was correct, they weren't very good. It's kind of like us. So a similar community in that your internet options are very limited. It's very, they get their take rate very, very quickly. They really, you know, wave the banner at each other. They love it. Jeff, you came to Mountains, and I just told you they are, and he loves it as well. So, I mean, as far as the service, it's a great service, but you do run a financial risk in that anything short of that bond payment you're coming up with on your own, and it's a monthly bond payment, so you gotta calculate that out the whole year.
And Utopia with Linden, I'm trying to pull this up again, but I believe, yes, they started in 2004. So between 2004 and 2020, they ended up with 7% take rate.
Yeah, so West Point here, which is currently under construction, I think size-wise, we're very similar to West Point, 7.2 million, 1.25. Morgan City, I mentioned that one, theirs is 2.5 million. They broke even 1 year early, so they did have to get into the projection rather quickly. And Layton, it's in the second half of their building, their project, they broke even 6 months early.
Which one did you say Clayton?
Morgan City broke even one year early.
So, have you ever been to Morgan? Yes, it's pretty rural.
That's surprising.
I'm surprised. I would think we would need that hands down.
I think so too, considering how many people I have walking around home. I think we have maybe a different demographic than Morgan that's probably higher than the
family. I'm fairly disciplined, so I think.
I like Morgan, we also have the options for the total Morgan did.
That's an okay phone, yes. They have like a 25-minute download plan, which won't do anything with that at this point. There's no commitment in an RFP. You can say, you know what, you choose to not do any of these. But there would have to be a little bit more certainty to be comfortable with moving forward.
I agree. And that's the only thing I'm trying to get down to is we can do this, and I do think several will like it. I don't know if it will be 50% who sign up. So the council just has to recognize that they are committing for the next 20 years for my sales tax revenue to make the shortfalls if it's not 50% take rate that entire month.
Have a bond issue, it's their big deal. And I don't like going into debt personally or in the city, it scares me. But at the same time, I think that people would jump on board.
I think we would say differently. I don't see this as a bond issue. I don't like to just because of the experience that
we have Cedars with two providers, and those are good options. Incredibly expensive prices. This is not, in my mind, if this was available, absolute greater. Now, the other question I've got, though, is long-term displaced infrastructure for more competition, more providers to come in, more technology that is supposedly, I think we need to look at those other ideas, too, because we don't want to be left with what we have right now, which is
yes, and so when we talked about hydro projects, whether it was the utopia, whether it was with kind of more of the American farm model, or some solar model, there's always a discussion of, well, when 5G comes, how are you going to be ready to implement that? And it's really interesting, it's really intriguing uses that you can use with 5G, and then we talked about strong profits. Talk about being required to install secondary water meters on every large unit to monitor the fresh air irrigation. Well, you can connect those to 5G to a provider so they can get real-time readings on where they are if you're charging 5 gallons. So there are some benefits. One, I mean, I think it's in the ground, but I don't think there's any because when I was discussing this with Charles, we brought up the question of, well, what about franchise fees? We're seeing a decrease in our franchise fees year over year on budget. This is the information I got. Was a cable and television service franchise fees, Comcast and Google Fiber consider their video services cable television, and they pay 5% cable franchise fees only on that service. On a municipal telecom tax, you can charge 3.5%, and that's the max mandated. That's the max allowed by state law. But on the internet service, no providers pay franchise fees for internet service, and that is subject to the Internet Tax Freedom Act. So you can't charge franchise fees on the internet service. So he says almost all cities are seeing a declining franchise tax revenue, thinking that this is due to the loss of Comcast customers, but it is usually caused more by Comcast customers canceling their video service from Comcast or going with an internet-only service, even if still using Comcast. So if I'm signed up with Xfinity Internet, I am not paying a franchise fee because I'm streaming that service through their internet rather than through the cable. It seems a little nuanced and it doesn't make a ton of sense, but that's the reality that we're living in. So this program would also probably see a further, or I'd say an accelerated decrease in franchise fees to us.
That's my one struggle with our model is that we take on all the risk, but don't receive any of the financial benefits. So if we have a 70% take rate, there's no way it keeps that. We don't plot in faster, it's just for a
26 years, because that two year that's all in and out of 2 years, it's a 20 number, it's 27 or.
So Chandler, did he say that there were any cities who had done this and had not gotten the 40% take rate? Well, I thought I remember that he said everyone had.
The take rate is dependent upon the construction as well. So our take rate is higher than what other cities are required to get because you guys may use backyards and a lot of rocks.
Yeah.
So in order to bore through everyone's front yard, or side yard, or backyard, and get them internet connection, it's going to be more laborious than it would be maybe in more comfortable there the soil looks like. Well, I just know that we have very rough soil, so they're anticipating a higher construction cost. Ergo, a higher take rate necessary to meet that bond obligation.
So I know Orem has a better take rate for the bigger cities, but part of that was also because they're still not finished. Still not built out for other cities, so that's part of the problem.
No, I mean,
but I believe Linden's the only one that's in the 50 cents one. With the exception of Linden Hills, but Linden Hills didn't finance their UIA, they paid for their construction themselves, and there was no other internet option. So,
and ours is 40, then not 50, right?
Well, Jack, we're saying 40 plus churches in commercial. If we don't have commercial churches, it's closer to 50. Okay.
Yeah, so and like I said, that's. I can wildly off on that, so take that with a grain of salt. But yeah, these communities are more, they're not all the way built out. I mean, I'll call my staff out. Jeff, you're on a utopia, you live in Orem, you love it. Colleen lives in Orem, does not have access to utopia, wishes she had, so.
And they're paying the difference with their sales tax revenue.
Yes.
And I don't love the debt either, I do tend to, I mean, I think it's moving this direction eventually, this is a utility, I mean, it's just something we have to have. So, I don't know, I'd like to see us be able to make it work, but I'm not for debt either, so.
What direction would you like staff to go?
RFP, I'd like to see.
Yeah, let's do the RFP.
I have about six right now ready.
Are there any further discussion on the American Portal to you?
So there's.
I kind of like dropped off.
And theirs has pretty much dropped off because of the dynamics. He's like pull out, and without another city to help them with this board, it just didn't make sense for them. But politically for them, it was ugly assessing everybody that they see.
That's what I thought, yeah.
But again, if we don't hit the 50% take rate, we're going to be doing the same things. Everyone's going to be paying for it just out of our general fund instead of as a base for the same cost.
Yes. And as far as the debt goes, the debt is not on the city, but even though we're the ones that are obligated to pay for it, it's shown on UIA and utilities. And that's really where we're going to park out. They wanted to do something similar and then making it an interlocal where the debt's carried by the interlocal with the obligation to pay by the city. But you need more than one city to make it an interlocal.
Yeah. And these will have something like three referendums filed against
the city. Yeah, because they got it. I remember that. I really like it.
Yeah. So they're on hold right now.
So, as far as I'm concerned, this is all we've got. So let's figure out the dark thing here.
Okay, I can prepare an RFP if that is the maintain the main points from the RFP that I've given and break them down into the RFP that you're comfortable with, which is going to share all the little tables, really valuable details. And bring those and present those to you. It seemed like when I reached out to other cities that they did solicit bids from other companies. Kind of knowing that some of those companies weren't going to be fulfilled. I mean, Roger said that he may welcome other business models to bid on the project as well, but nobody's been able to meet Utopia at this point, so you still have to go to RFP.
So in one way, I almost wish it was the city getting the bond itself, instead we have to vote on it, and then we know whether or not residents are in favor of doing it. Because when we did the survey, how many people responded? Okay, so it's how many 200 out of our entire population in the city? I don't know if that's a great thermometer.
Honestly, it's low for a survey.
Here's my issue with surveys, and we've talked about this in the past with other surveys as well, is in fact, when we did the survey the last October, when we talked about swimming pool, I was really adamant, and so I was Councilmember Zapala at the time, that we show examples that here's what the pool would look like, and here's how much the debt would be, and here's what the user fee would be, would you still go for it? And every single time they said no. They said yes, we want a pool, but then when they saw that they got it, it was awesome. And when the property tax increase would be, they said no. So my only issue with the Utopia one is it gave some options, but there was never a question in there of, do you think the city should do this with the understanding that the city may be liable for a difference if we don't have a 50% take rate in 2 years? And if we have a 10% take rate, this is what it's going to cost everybody. A 20% take rate, this is what's going to happen here. So it's really easy to ask these, do you want them? And everyone says, yeah, I want them. But when you don't say, here are the possible consequences, I don't think you really get a true indication of whether or not
it would
be supported, they
had
all of them.
And I think that can be messaged very clearly, but at this point, I wouldn't recommend doing it with a survey.
Yes.
If you do another fiber survey, it looks like you're dragging your feet and not really making decisions. So I think based on the information you've got in our feedback, we get to take those estimates and say, now we know what our exact take rate would have to be, and this is how we meet this. our bonding obligation would be each month. Knowing that, if we're short, how willing are you residents to pay up for the shortfall?
Do you base the tier grade, the percentage off of the lowest tier of service?
The 250, yes.
And I'm not taking into account that bonding would want to put it.
Because the $30 goes to the bond, everything else would go to the ISP, so it doesn't matter what speed they get. And that's where I'm saying that's the ultimate downfall, is if we have great, like, you know, Berlin Hills, if we have 70% of the people sign up, we can't take that extra money to pay our bond after fire. It's kept by utopia to pay for losses in other areas.
So here's my question though, like, that's the model represented to us, is that we can't do that? Can we negotiate that though? Or is that just the way it is?
You can try, but I doubt you're going to be able to.
Here's the problem, is the member cities, the founding cities, there's no way to go over that, because they took such a financial loss for so many years, they're not going to tell us we don't have to take that same risk.
That board is pretty much run by Oregon and West Valley.
They have a majority of
them. They carry the day. And so I would be shocked beyond words if they said, yeah, that sounds good.
In fact, they're pretty anxious for additional cities to come on to help offset their losses. It just seems like if they're anxious for us to come on, though, because we don't like their terms, then we're not coming on, and then we're not throwing them out, you know what I mean? So, but we're not coming on that way. If we get to keep the profit, we're still helping them out. They only get to benefit if we exceed our take rate and they get to keep it.
Right, but it's more appealing to us if we might come on, otherwise we make it ugly for us and we're not coming. And,
the mayor and I were we attended a meeting out in Lehigh where we met with a bunch of cities in the area, and this is a presentation from Springville, who before the current Telecoms Act, they created their own fiber network. They were their own ISP. So their model is a little bit different than what we can do. But looking at their profit, what they're supplementing to the general fund, and kind of extrapolating numbers saying, Springville, you're this big, Spanish Fork. You're this big and you supplement your fund with your general fund with this much money. Well, we're this big, we'd be supplementing with this much money. It just visually it didn't pan out that it was a financial boon to the city to do it this other way. So at that point, I think that's when the utopia model became more of a let's look at this in terms of, is this a service that residents need? Recognizing that it's not a financial boon of the general fund, or is it something that we should just kind of say, not right now? Because there's not really any other options.
And that's why American Fork and Lehigh have looked at doing their own thing, because they couldn't get into a different model. And I get why they're not a different model. Those cities took financial losses for so long that they're not going to bring on more work without signing that into them. There's just nothing in it for them. But that's the hard part, and that's why American people like to do where they own it themselves. Same with the United. And they're a lot more bigger than we are, and a lot more commercial space than we do. That's
so for tonight.
It sounds like an RP, that's what they want. That's
good. We will prepare that.
Okay. This is number 11, discussion on the cemetery. Oh, and let me start and introduce this. We had a resident, Chandler and I had a resident reach out to us. We just lived here for at least about 3 years. And he wanted to know why we didn't have a cemetery. And when we went through all the reasons, he wanted to know if we would either be willing to look at building a cemetery or offering some kind of a subsidy for residents if they wanted to be buried somewhere else. And so we gave him the background that the Chandler and I were talking about, and we realized, I think other than me and Mike, I don't think anybody else on the council was in here for this discussion. We had it probably 5 years or so, so we thought it would be the opportunity to bring it back to the council so you understand why you don't want to
spend it. It has been 6 years since we revisited this, so it's been a while. So basically, there's two issues that we have to overcome. One is where you put the cemetery, two is how you pay for the cemetery. So let's start with number one. When we evaluated this issue 6 years ago, we identified a possible location for a cemetery. Chiefly among them were this area that's up behind Silver Lake Drive over against the hillside there. The city owns open space. We looked at land there, and then if you go up there, there's homes, and then you can see a lot of the shoreline trail runs right behind those homes. There's a nice flat spot, and it starts to go gradually, you know, against the rest of the city. We looked at that because it can also be on that area right here. But it's this area, it's SG. The idea was that you'd come up off of this road here. We have to build an access point, and this area here would be the cemetery. We excluded about 100 feet from the homes because that is where the aqueduct easement was. They don't want trees on the aqueduct. I'm pretty sure they don't want poplars either. So we just assumed that we couldn't put the cemetery on top of the aqueduct. So this is the area that we looked at. When we were looking at that, and these are 2014 prices. Cost estimates.
We looked at probably about 4 or 5 sites.
This was the one that was most logical. We estimated that you have to pay for grading, you have to pay for excavation, for the road, for leveling out an area to be smooth and nice enough for a cemetery. You have to add asphalt for the roads out there, you have to have a series of retaining walls. Around the cemetery, you have to add irrigation, soil, landscaping, restrooms, signage, survey plots. You have to add a counter software and a gate. And that was your startup up front. You built the cemetery cost. Back then, we estimated that to be $600,000 to $750,000. That's 6 years ago. So, my quote was a building price that's done in the last 6 years. I think that might have been issued already. But yes, you're right. I think you're looking at least $1 million in infrastructure to build a cemetery on this location. Another location that we talked about was Harvard Park. Pretty sure you don't want to Harvard Cemetery there. But another location we talked about was St. Andrews in this area. One of the big drawbacks there was the golf balls. They're everywhere. So this was a short-lived discussion here in that we'd still have to pay for a serious system of netting there to protect the cemetery. So you're not really financially ahead at all. And also, there's a sunk cost here that you're walking away from 22 paper lots right now. So you're walking away from an asset creating liability for the city. Liability numbers for a lot of
it was, I mean, you still get.
There is, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. The final location I can think of right now, it's still not great, but it's this parcel right here. And that's the cottage is designated park, but it's still a very difficult parcel. When I was looking at the, getting back up to speed on this, Highland Cemetery is 16.5 acres, AF Cemetery is 25.16 acres. I think in order to really do it right, you have to look at a piece of land that's about 5 acres in our size to Highland size. You have to look at least 5 acres, otherwise, I don't know if it would be really worth it. So that's the land development, land acquisition cost to do a cemetery. The second item that has to be overcome, it might be easier than the first one, but it's still very challenging, is that you have to pay for the cemetery. Once you get into the cemetery business, there's no turning back. You are committed. Unless you're one of those old pioneer cemeteries and some of your tellers number. But we move on now. So you have to establish some way that the maintenance of the cemetery goes on. Work to it. So what some cities do, and some states require you to do this, but I don't believe Utah is one of them, but they establish perpetual care funds And it's the basic synopsis of this is that maintenance costs are a significant portion of most cemeteries. That's really the nominal cost to build here. And the cost includes groundkeeping, road repairs, general maintenance, upkeep, and cemetery construction. Cemetery maintenance is not usually covered by upkeep or repair of monuments, headstones, and grave monuments. But cemeteries receive the income generated from the perpetual care trust to help offset the cost of maintenance. Without the income from the perpetual care trust, it would be very difficult for cemeteries to cover the cost of maintenance from the current operating revenue. But in order to get enough interest income from the trust, you have to establish it with enough seed money that you're getting enough money, so that you're getting enough money annually to do maintenance. So at that point, you're having to commit, I would say, ballpark, and this is, again, back in the napkin calculation, you're looking at $500,000 to $1 million sitting, you're setting this aside to accrue interest to help year over year maintenance of a cemetery. And then when people buy a plot, it goes into that fund and it helps to deepen that source of income year over year for the city. But that doesn't even begin to cover the fact that you now have another maintenance obligation and you have another general obligation to the residents that when there's a need for burial, you have to have a few staff members that come out to do that. So you're looking at American Fortress dedicated to their cemetery. In 2014, we had 12 to 13 employees. Many of those were seasonal employees that did maintenance throughout the summer, but about 6 full-time employees. So I think you'd be looking at, for the city of Marseille, you're looking at least 2, more likely 3 employees, which, I mean, you're adding another probably $200,000 into the general fund budget when you talk about benefits, salaries, and other costs of having an employee. And then you got we haven't even talked about the fact that we need a tractor. A really good show. So anyway, that's the brief synopsis of cemeteries that's here to us.
So how much, and you mentioned the one person who came, like how often do we get this request? How many people do we get it?
I've heard it a number of times, but many times it's been a single individual. But it comes up 2-3 times a year.
Yeah, I get it occasionally. Yeah.
So
I've been asked several times.
And do you think it's just a general query, why don't we have one? Or do you think it's more I have to pay more to go down to American Fork if I don't
see the bill? Well, I think because oftentimes, and I correct me wrong on general, but I think when you do it is American Fork and you want to get buried in their cemetery, there's a resident rate versus a non-resident rate.
Typically there is.
Yeah.
So they're thinking, I think a lot of the thought process is, well, do I get a discount if I apply and see your bill because I'm a resident of the city, we don't have a cemetery, so maybe that's the chance to save money. That's probably some of it. Some of it maybe just want to stay here, I don't know. But I just remember the numbers, I mean, you talked about the sexton, you have to have all these people. I mean, it's just prohibitive back 6 years ago. It's probably going to have worse sets.
Cost isn't coming lower.
And honestly, Guan and Island and AI.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah, how much are they?
Okay. So I was curious because I had this study that Highland did in 2014, and it showed the plot purchase and then the open and closing costs for residents, non residents, weekends, weekdays. So let's take American Fork, for instance. Their plot purchase in 2014 was $800, now it's $1,300. I couldn't identify, it doesn't look like they distinguish between residents and non-residents.
Private?
This is American Fork. And then the cost to inter for a resident versus non-resident is still at $600. They went from $350 a weekday to $600 a weekday. On a weekend, it went from $550 to $850. Highland, it's their study. They're not included yet. But so I apologize, I don't have theirs. But let's look at Pleasant Grove, for instance. A plot purchase for a resident used to be $400, and now it's $800. And
in just 6 years.
Yeah. And for a non-resident, it's from $1,000 to $1,600. Interment for residents is $700, and interment for non-residents is $1,300. Draper, their cost went from $500 a lot to, we no longer have lots available for sale. So, I mean, at some point we run out of space. But in every case, inevitably, the cost to purchase a plot of ground did go up. I do hear the non-resident complaint saying it's more expensive to be buried as a non-resident. I've also heard the viewpoint that you're not a real city until you have a cemetery. I don't know if that's like a backhanded insult.
I've heard that with libraries too.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I think people need to understand, like we try to explain to them with libraries too, though, that the people who live in those cities are also supplementing those things with their taxes. So to say, well, I have to pay the non-resident rate, well, yes, you do, because we're not taxing you. And I tend to lean a little more towards user fees in a small community like we are. But I love the library system that you have, or the internet, and other ones. Well, the library system, that's another issue. But I like that we reimburse our residents to go where they want to go, to libraries that are already set up, and because I don't want to take on bond debt, I don't want to build a huge library, I don't want to commit to something that, you know, once you do it, we're in forever. I lived in Hartford Park when they expanded the cemetery, and that was tumultuous. It was, and it's never enough. So it's never enough that you've got to buy more land, you've got to get more people. So I don't love the idea, and I don't love any of those locations. So I think people need, sometimes when people ask questions, they don't have all the information either about, you know, people that need to supplement those cemeteries by law.
And as the mayor said, I mean, we've asked this a while, quite a bit, and it's been a while since we looked at this, and when we were discussing it, it was, let's talk about it, because I don't think this council was part of these discussions. But the other question that wasn't brought up was, well, why don't we supplement more like a library income or work out a trade with, you know, a resident of another city in order to get resident rates? Well, I don't know that we have to negotiate. I'm also not willing to, I would not recommend to the council to set up funds similar to our library reimbursement program when we have a plot purchase reimbursement program, where we'll pay the first $1,000, and we haven't been able
to. And I explained to him, we don't actually have any libraries. Yeah. We just have this fund that we reimburse our resident, but we don't have any Reno Highlander or anybody else library fee. How they.
This individual also used the American Port Police, and it was a barter period, and it's just not.
There's something, let's figure that out. We'll give you free family festival passes.
I think it's a worthy discussion. I think it's great to bring it up and show. I think we understand it, so thank you.
Yeah, I just offered you the residence information. You said, what talks are we talking about?
Is there anything you'd like me to follow up on with the secretary or staff to follow up on?
He did recommend that we purchase the blocked property because they're not interested in selling their property anymore.
I just don't think the city with its reimbursement money, we're not in the funeral money business. So I just, that's not our responsibility. So. Yeah, private cemetery. Someone wants to have a personal order.
That's for all of you.
Thomas and Hanson.
All right. If there are no other questions, I will take a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion to adjourn.
Motion made by Councilmember Smith. Is there a second? I'm sorry, can I say it? Councilmember Adams, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Your turn.